out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 16th of October 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Well, we are halfway through the week. It's Wednesday. That means we have revisionist historian Carolyn Yeager with us today from carolynyeager.net. Carolyn, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Oh, good morning. I'm doing pretty well. The weather has changed here. I won't go into any detail, but, you know, it's definitely a change in the weather, and fall is here and winter on the way.
Yeah, certainly a nip in the air. I'm feeling that here as well, and the clocks will be changing soon. I think you like it when the clocks change, don't you?
Well, I did. I've just really been changing. I'm becoming a summer person and not a winter person. So now I'm not so thrilled about winter coming, but it's not that long, and we have a long fall, and then spring starts, and it never gets that bad. So
you can't ever get that bad in Texas, can it? It's got to be good weather there.
Well, not where I am. I don't think I'd like it up in Dallas. I think that's too cold. That's too much contrast in the. They have just as hot a summer and a worse winter, so I wouldn't want to be there.
We're going to be talking today about Thomas Dalton's book Hitler on the Jews, and I think I've heard the name before, but I haven't actually read any of his books. But it looks like he has quite a few books out talking about Holocaust revisionism and Adolf Hitler, and this one looks particularly good. And I know that you've been really enjoying reading it, and you want to talk about that today, Carolyn. So shall we get into this book by Thomas Dalton?
Yes, let's do it. And you know, just a little bit about Thomas Dalton. I've read everything he's put out except for his newest things, which this is one of them, which have just kind of all come out. And you know, he is the one who wrote the book Debating the Holocaust, that back in a number of years ago became very effective in bringing forth the revisionist point of view, because it showed both sides, and it went through all the most important, controversies about Holocaust revisionism. And he's very, very good at making things plain and easy to understand. I just love his writing. I think my writing tends to be like that too. I try to make it not so complex that people lose interest and can't follow it. He's an American, so he speaks, his English is very American-like, and I think I relate to that. Well, then he's the one who has written this, he's done this translation. He wrote a lot of good articles, long ones, about Goebbels on, what's Goebbels' first name? Joseph Goebbels, and various things, and published them on revisionist websites. And then he did this translation. He knows German. He translated Mein Kampf. And I know you're such a fan of Mein Kampf. And he did this great new translation, which I just love. And it's I like the Murphy translation, but now this one, I just absolutely. So I bought his, he had volume one out. It's in two volumes, very big, and he has a dual translation, which is German on the left side of the two pages open, and English on the right side. So you can actually compare how he translates it from the German, if you are able to do that. And I like having that. So I bought that dual translation. It also comes in just the English for less money. But and then his just not so long ago, the volume 2 of the Mein Kampf came out, and I have that. I haven't actually read it yet, but I have it. And then from that, he created this book, which is not a big book, but it's very well organized, I think, and I'm liking it. He created this book from all his, it's got a lot of what he wrote in Mein Kampf in it, and then it's got his early speeches. The table of contents is the, you know, the introduction, and then part one, part two, and part three. And part one is very good, origins and overview, but it gives hit for Mein Kampf Hitler's what he wrote early on about how he learned about Jews and what his early thoughts were about it, and how when he went to Vienna he finally saw real Jews, and then he got interested and looked into it all, and from that developed his particular form or a type of anti-Semitism. And he doesn't deny he's an anti-Semite, and he explains it though in a wonderful to me way. And then you have the early speeches of 1922 and 1923. He's got a lot of from those 2 years speeches, all taken place in Munich. And you know, I've talked to him, and he I told him about I have Hitler's 1920 speech, which I got, which someone translated for me, and I have it on my website. And you don't ever see that anywhere. It's also in Munich, and it's a speech he gave in 1920 that's actually titled "Why We Are Anti-Semites." It's his National Socialist Party and earliest form, because it started in 1919, and he titled it "Why We Are Anti-Semites." And Thomas Dalton said, "Boy," he said, "I'm just kicking myself that I didn't know about that." See, people don't look at my website. They should, but they forget what you know. And there's lots of good stuff there. And he said, "If I do a revision of this book, you know, a new edition, I mean, of this book, I will definitely ask you for permission to use your translation there of this speech." So anyway, he doesn't have it, though. He starts with 1922, but it's very good. And then part three is thematic topics, and he's got various topics and what Hitler says about the Jews. And I will say the majority of it comes from Mein Kampf, which he, you know, translated and became very familiar with. But it has, and this is what I'm going to start with. It has, at the beginning of that part three, the first letter on the Jews that Hitler wrote on 16 September 1919. And so he understands this as the first thing that is we have that was ever published. He wrote this letter in September 1919 to Herr Gemlich. Herr Gemlich or Gemlich, Gemlich, I guess. And I'm going to read it and comment, because it's just a letter, but it's not real short, but everything in it is so good. And you know what he says here? And what's impressive is that, as Dalton says, he was 30 years of age when he wrote this. And it was shortly after the end of the World War, in which he was severely injured and had this problem with his eyes. And he witnessed the Jewish role in the German Revolution of November 1918. And he says this seems to be his first written statement on the Jews. And so that's what we've got here. You want to say anything before I start reading this?
No, it sounds great. I'm intrigued to find out what was in that first statement of his.
Okay. He says, "Dear Herr Gemlich, if the threat with which Jewry faces our people has given rise to undeniable hostility on the part of a large section of our people, the cause of this hostility must be sought in the clear recognition that Jewry as such is deliberately or unwittingly having a pernicious effect on our nation, but mostly in personal intercourse, in the poor impression the Jew makes as an individual. He says, as a result, anti-Semitism far too readily assumes a purely emotional character. But this is not the correct response. Anti-Semitism as a political movement may not and cannot be molded by emotional factors, but only by recognition of the facts. Now the facts are these. So you see his approach. He's not promoting an emotional reaction against Jews by the people, which is what he's always accused of. You know, and we find that everything that's true about Hitler, and it's in writing, is you know, opposite to what they try to promote him as, which is this rabble rouser playing on the emotions of the people and so on. So he says, goes on in the letter, to begin with, the Jews are unquestionably a race, not a religious community. And we know that Hitler considered races as much smaller classifications than is the current science of, you know, three major races or five or something, maybe, you know, in the world. That's not how he uses the word race. He goes on, the Jew himself never describes himself as a German, as a Jewish German, a Jewish Pole, or a Jewish American, but always as a German, Polish, or American Jew. Jews have never adopted more than the language of the foreign nation in whose midst they live. A German who is forced to make use of the French language in France, Italian in Italy, Chinese in China, does not thereby become a Frenchman, Italian, or Chinaman, nor can we call a Jew who happens to live amongst us and who is therefore forced to use the German language a German. Neither does the Mosaic faith, however great its importance for the preservation of that race, be the sole, that's kind of funny English there, but be the sole criterion for deciding who is a Jew and who is not. There is hardly a race in the world whose members all belong to a single religion. And, well, we know, we may think of all Jews are of the Jewish religion, but there's religious Jews and non-religious Jews. There's secular Jews. And even the Jewish religion is not practiced the same everywhere in the world. So that's, I don't know, that's how I would interpret that. Continuing, through inbreeding for thousands of years, often in very small circles, that's the important thing, the Jew has been able to preserve his race and his racial characteristics much more successfully than most of the numerous people among whom he has lived. And as an aside here for me, Hitler has said elsewhere that, you know, when he talks about race, it's a group of people who have bred together for a long enough time to make their racial characteristics appear with every new birth. So that's what he means by race, and that's why he thinks Jews are a race, because there's all these people and say, oh, they're not a race, and blah, blah, blah. But he uses that because he says Jews, when they have children, they have the same characteristics all the time. That's what he calls a race. He calls the Germans a race, and he calls the Jews a race. So he says, as a result, there lives amongst us a non-German alien race, unwilling and indeed unable to shed its racial characteristics, its particular feelings, thoughts, and ambitions, and nevertheless enjoying the same political rights as we ourselves do. And since even the Jew's feelings are limited to the purely material realm, his thoughts and ambitions are bound to be so even more strongly. Their dance around the golden calf becomes a ruthless struggle for all the possessions that we feel, we Germans feel deep down, are not the highest and not the only ones worth striving for on this earth. That's one of the biggest ways he contrasts Germans and Jews, you know, is that Germans have a spiritual element and level in themselves, and Jews don't, despite all their talk about their religion. Continuing, the value of an individual is no longer determined by his character. You know, with Jews in control, let's say, the value of an individual is no longer determined by his character or by the significance of his achievements for the community, but solely by the size of his fortune, his wealth. The greatness of a nation is no longer measured by the sum of its moral and spiritual resources, but only by the wealth of its material possessions. All this results in that mental attitude and that quest for money and the power to protect it that allow the Jew to become so unscrupulous in his choice of means, so merciless in his use of his own ends. In autocratic states, he cringes before the majesty of the princes and misuses their favors to become a leech on the people. In democracies, he vies for the favor of the masses, cringes before the majesty of the people, but only recognizes the majesty of money. He saps the prince's character with Byzantine flattery, national pride, and the strength of the nation the people, with ridicule and shameless seduction to vice. His method of battle is that of public opinion, which is never expressed in the press, but which is nonetheless managed and falsified by it. His power is the power of the money, which multiplies in his hands effortlessly and endlessly through interest, and with which he imposes a yoke upon the nation that is the more pernicious in that its glitter disguises its ultimately tragic consequences. Everything that makes the people strive for higher goals, be it religion, socialism, or democracy, is to the Jew merely a means to an end, the way to satisfy his greed and thirst for power. So all this is his giving of what he calls the facts of why it is natural or normal to be anti-Semitic, not an emotional reaction because you see individual Jews doing things that you don't like and you have an angry reaction to it and you know all of that. He wants to show exactly why they are bad for the nation. And so then he says the result of his works, the Jews' works, is racial tuberculosis of the nation. You know, it's funny that, you know, Jews and those who don't like this kind of thinking will say that this is emotional, that this is not factual, this is, you know, what they label anti-Semitism is speaking badly of Jews and accusing them of things that as a group that they don't do. But he says they do all this, and we know they do. We see the results of it. So, but you know, that's what goes on here. So he continues. And this has the following consequences. Purely emotional anti-Semitism finds its final expression in the form of pogroms. That's what he doesn't like. He says rational anti-Semitism, by contrast, must lead to a systematic and legal struggle against an eradication of the privileges the Jews enjoy over the other foreigners living amongst us. And in parentheses, it's says alien laws, and I don't know who that comes from, but maybe that's Dalton, because that is, I was going to say myself, that is what Hitler instituted with the Nuremberg laws, you know, that slowly restricting Jews more and more in the country of Germany, and made it legal. Not just to go out and attack Jews, but made it legal. And that, you know, you can say they shouldn't have done that, but that's what all laws are. You know, it's decided by the people in power. So its final objective, however, the final objective of, uh, of a systematic and legal struggle against the Jews is must be the total removal of all Jews from our midst. So there you go. Right there in 1919, he said, the objective is the total removal of Jews from our midst. Not the extermination, not the, we're not going to go out and kill them. We're not going to do all this secretive stuff. It's all going to be out in the open. So that's my comment there. But so he goes on after removal of all Jews from our midst to say that both objectives can only be achieved by a government of national strength and not one of national impotence. Now, that's what he saw. His National Socialist government is a government of national strength that was going to do what was necessary to help Germans in Germany and not be impotent. So then he goes on. This is close to the end now. The German Republic, which was the Weimar Republic at that time, owes its birth not to the united national will of our people, but to the underhanded exploitation of a series of circumstances that, taken together, express themselves in a deep universal dissatisfaction. These circumstances, however, arose independently of the political structure and are at work even today, indeed, more so than ever before. Hence, a large part of our people recognizes that changing the structure of the state cannot in itself improve our position, but that this can only be achieved by the rebirth of the nation's moral and spiritual forces. Now, this was the goal that Hitler's fledgling little National Socialist Party set for itself, very big, you know, to renew the nation's whole moral and spiritual force. So continuing, and this rebirth cannot be prepared by the leadership of an irresponsible majority, that is, democracy, that's me saying that, an irresponsible majority influenced by party dogmas or by the internationalist catchphrases and slogans of an irresponsible press, but only by determined acts on the part of nationally minded leadership with an inner sense of responsibility. I think that phrase is very important because that was the sense, and that is the justification behind the Führer principle, you know, that is kind of unique to Germany, and that, you know, that you have a leader who is responsive to the people and has an inner sense of responsibility to the people and to the nation, is not just a part of this irresponsible newspaper press and media dominated majority and so on that never really cares about the people. So this is how they justify it, and they think that, and I like that term, inner sense of responsibility. So last paragraph of this letter, he says, this very fact serves to deprive the Republic of the inner support of the spiritual forces any nation needs very badly. Spiritual again. Hence, the present leaders of the nation are forced to seek support from those who alone have benefited and continue to benefit from changing the form of the German state, and who for that very reason became the driving force of the revolution, the Jews. Disregarding the Jewish threat, which is undoubtedly recognized even by today's leaders, as various statements from prominent personalities reveal, these men are forced to accept Jewish favors to their private advantage and to repay these favors. Wow. And the repayment does not merely involve satisfying every possible Jewish demand, but above all, preventing the struggle of the betrayed people against its defrauders by sabotaging the anti-Semitic movement. Now, that is the end. It doesn't have a saying, you know, yours sincerely, Adolf Hitler, or anything like that. So I'm a little slightly confused if that's the actual ending of the letter or if it ended on the previous page. But it seems like that goes with it. And then there's a new section called Democracy, where he writes about his thoughts about democracy. So I just think that is a very impressive letter, and so many clues in there as to what Hitler did for up until 1945. You know, he was always consistent. He never changed. You know, basically, his basic ideas that he developed back then and under such inspiration, he felt, for what Germany needed, and that it needed people who had the will and the strength of will to carry out what was necessary. And that's what he intended to do. And that's what he selected people that he thought would do that too. You know, that had that too in his party. And that was his objective. That was his, what he was all about.
You know, it reminds me a bit of Cornelius Codriano when he was writing about the Jews. It was always very, very scientific and not appealing to emotion. And the really interesting thing about that is when he pointed out about how he was against the pogroms, because that was the emotional reaction to what the Jews were doing. And the way to deal with it is is legally through the state. And the way you do it through the state is by pointing out what it is that the Jews have been doing to the nation, which is harmful to the nation, and removing the privileges that they have that protect them from being exposed as doing that. It was all legitimately done. It was all above board. And this is just the sort of thing that the establishment today doesn't want you to hear, because they want you to think that Adolf Hitler was a madman. He was just somebody that looked good to the people, and they followed him. And then halfway through, he just suddenly went mad and gassed all these Jews. And that's the narrative that we're told today. And that shatters that narrative. It sounds like a really interesting author. Is Thomas Dalton. I think I'm going to have to look out some of his books, Carolyn.
You should know about him. He's very important in my mind, and one of the best sources for understanding Hitler. What's come? He started out with revisionism, you know, Holocaust, and by, I guess, you know, German or something, and then translating Mein Kampf, he became a great admirer of Adolf Hitler. And now he's focusing on Hitler, and his view and the way he talks about Hitler is just very much, you know, in line with my own, because I think that I have the most accurate understanding of Hitler of anybody alive. But no, I'm not going to find too much agreement about that, I know. But but he's really close to that. So he's now pretty much, you know, trying to bring about a better understanding of Adolf Hitler and his whole party, his whole program and everything, not just Holocaust revisionism. So for that reason, I really like him. And this book is better than I thought. Well, I know everything that Hitler said about the Jews, so I don't need that book. But I was online and I was looking, buying some things, and then this book popped up, you know, as well, you might want this because of my buying history, I guess. And I said, yeah, I should get that book after all. I'm so glad I did. I'm really glad I did. I'm enjoying it. It's a good resource.
Well, hopefully some of our listeners will appreciate that as well, and maybe they'll purchase it, because obviously the guy's got to make his money from selling his books. That's Thomas Dalton, Hitler on the Jews. Thank you very much for coming on today, Carolyn. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.